So I'm reading from Mark chapter 15, and I'm going to start at verse 6. And what I'm going to read here involves a lot of kingship language, okay? And so what I want you to do is, as we read through, I want you to note where you see kingship or enthronement language. Does that sound reasonable? So I'll read it, you make note, and then we'll have a real quick discussion after about that, okay? Mark 15, verse 6. Now at the feast, he used to release, this is Pilate, used to release for them one prisoner for whom they had asked. And among the rebels in prison who had committed murder in the insurrection, there was a man called Barabbas. And the crowd came up and began to ask Pilate to do as he usually did for them. And he answered them, saying, "Do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews?" For he perceived that it was out of envy that the chief priests had delivered him up. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd to have him release for them Barabbas instead. And Pilate again said to them, "Then what shall I do with this man you call the king of the Jews?" And they cried out again, "Crucify him." And Pilate said to them, "Why, what evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Crucify him." So Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, released for them Barabbas, and having scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. And the soldiers led him away inside the palace, that is the governor's headquarters, and they called together the whole battalion, and they clothed him in a purple cloak, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on him. And they began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they were striking his head with a reed and spitting on him, and kneeling down in homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the purple cloak and put his own clothes on him. And they led him out to crucify him. Okay, so very briefly then, where do you see the language of kingship and enthronement in this passage? Let's take 1 minute with your neighbor, and then we'll bring it all together, okay? 1 minute with your neighbor, where do you see or where do you hear the language of kingship or enthronement? Okay, what have you got? What have you got? Anybody got? There's some easy ones. Yeah, let's go, Mike. Purple robe, very good. The mantle of royalty. Anyone else? Crown, very good. Nate? Yeah, again, you see the irony, right? They're saying true words, but they're not saying it with any kind of tone of respect or admiration, right? Anyone else? A palace, interesting. Very good, Peter. You got one that I didn't think of, the palace. Yeah, why in the palace? Yeah, good. Anyone else? Fell on their knees. Yeah, they're kneeling down, paying homage. Good. Last one. Soldiers. Yeah, I like that one. That wasn't obvious to me. When I was studying this week, someone pointed that out to me. Here you have a whole battalion of men. Probably a little overkill. Boy, that's not a nice thing to say. A little overdone, right? Overdone that they need a whole battalion of men around this Jesus, right? Interesting. Okay, let's plow in then. So 3 times Pilate calls him King of the Jews. Interesting, he never calls him Jesus. He calls him the King of the Jews. The purple cloak, the robe of royalty fit for a king, the crown of thorns that the soldiers make is a strange kind of coronation, an ironic coronation. The soldiers saluting, a whole battalion of soldiers gathered around like any other king, except they're not there to serve him, they're there to finish him off. Hail, King of the Jews. This is later in verse 18. They're shouting, "Hail, King of the Jews." That's actually from the religious leaders. Isn't that wild? The irony is so twisted and so interesting here. Then the kneeling down and paying homage in verse 19. Much later, verse 26, the inscription over the cross is King of the Jews. And you might recall that in John's gospel, the Jewish leaders went to Pilate and said, "Hey, wait a minute, you got to change that sign. That's a little too unironic for us. We wanted to say, 'He said, I am the King of the Jews,' but he said, 'No, what I've written, I've written,' so we're going to leave it." And then, of course, the religious leaders saying, "Let the Messiah, the King of Israel, come down now." Interesting statement. The other thing I noticed, even just this morning, was in the crucifixion, you've got Jesus in the middle and a man on his right and on his left. a weird kind of enthronement, especially since just earlier the disciples had said, "Can we sit on your right and your left?" And Jesus said, "I don't think you can drink the cup that I'm going to drink." It's a strange kind of enthronement. The worst kind of throne is a cross. And so we have here these ironic enthronement statements and a tension, a different perspective. And what are we to make of this? How are we to understand these different perspectives? For the Roman soldiers, this is complete mockery. They do not think that this weak and dying man is a king at all. In fact, weak and dying is the opposite of what a king is. It's laughable to them. Kings are powerful, and they crush opposition with violence. For the religious leaders, again, the kingship is irony. It's a joke to them. The king that they had in mind would not end in this way. Their perspective was that this was meaningless. There was no significance. He was just another revolutionary who was going to end on a cross, an imposter. That's what they thought. But if this is the irony on one side, what's the other perspective? What's the other take? And there may have been, I've been wrestling with this question, could there have been people who rightly understood what was taking place at that time, in that moment? Those who listened carefully to what Jesus said, those who heard him predict his death and resurrection, his suffering, he had said it all before. And could there have been some who understood what was taking place? Those who listened to his teaching. And in Mark chapter 8, Jesus had predicted his suffering and death and his resurrection. In 8:35, he says, "For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it." So somehow, losing your life is saving. And if someone had listened carefully, they might have a hint of an understanding of what was taking place. Or again in chapter 9, another prediction of his suffering and death and resurrection, and Jesus says, "If anyone would be first, he must be last of all and servant of all." So if they were listening, if they were piecing the parts of the puzzle together, I kind of doubt it, but maybe, you know? And then chapter 10, again, another prediction of his suffering and death and resurrection, and Jesus said, "You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them, but it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be the slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." Maybe. Maybe someone heard his teaching. Maybe a few heard it and understood it, and they maybe in part comprehended the events. They understood that what Jesus said was the path to greatness was very different than what they had imagined before. Maybe a small measure of understanding that this irony was actually the way that God was pronouncing Jesus king, the true king, the least becoming the greatest, the last becoming the first, the servant becoming the Lord of all. What do you think? Can we do a show of hands? Do you think anybody got this? Anybody want to say they think so? You think so, yeah? A couple of folk that are related in the front row here? I'm afraid to ask, but can you answer quick? What makes you think that? Yeah, so is Ben-Hur fictional or is it part? Is it fictional? So in Ben-Hur, there's the story of some who understood. I was thinking, we had a sermon a few weeks ago about the woman who anointed Jesus for his burial. She understood something. And then this guy, Joseph of Arimathea, who we learn about later, he comprehended something. I don't know if he understood the whole thing. But whatever the case, the irony of the enthronement is that some mocked and some ridiculed and struck and spat, but some may have understood the beginning of a truth, like the woman who anointed Jesus. Perhaps there was a hint of an idea that maybe this was the way that God was moving because of the things Jesus had said plainly. He said them straight up. So, yeah, the irony then is these perspectives. But someone else was watching. Someone else was watching these events. And while others were ridiculing and spitting and beating Jesus, Someone else saw the crown go on his head. Someone else saw the purple robe. Someone else saw the kneeling and the homage that was paid to him. Someone else saw it all, right? You see that God himself was watching from the heavens, and what he saw was the one true human who was fit to rule over his creation. The one faithful human of all humanity. He saw his son enthroned. The one who lost his life to save so many. The one who took the last place in order to be given the first place. The one who became the servant of all who found true greatness. On the other side of this ironic tension with soldiers and religious leaders, the other side of it, God saw it all without a hint of irony. He saw the obedience and the sacrifice and the love poured out for others. And in Philippians chapter 2, Paul records what God thought about these events. Philippians 2 is really helpful for us today. And what God did in response is recorded there as well. Paul says, Jesus, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant. By being born in the likeness of men and by being found in human form. Okay, so he lowers himself to become a human, but then he lowers himself again by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on the cross. He moved from heaven to become human, but he moved to the lowest of humanity by being humiliated on the cross. And what Paul writes about here, God took note of the servanthood. The sacrifice, the obedience, the love of Jesus. God saw it all. He saw the mocking crown and the false homage. He saw the purple robe and he saw the abuse. And he saw it all and he saw Jesus' unwillingness to strike back. And what did God do with that? Verse 9, therefore God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name. That at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. What we celebrate today in the resurrection is God's endorsement, his stamp of approval. He looked on these same events and unironically declared Jesus to be king by raising him from the dead. God, seeing his faithfulness, his obedience, and his love, he raised Jesus from the dead and declared him to be ruler over all. This is what happens in the resurrection. And Mark invites us to see these events then differently, to see them the way that God does, from his perspective. Instead of mockery, to see that the irony is an invitation to a completely different perspective. His shameful death is actually the triumph of a king over evil. Helen Bond is a professor at Edinburgh, strangely, And she says it this way. Through the framing device of the triumph, Mark shows that what looked to an outsider to be the depths of suffering, humiliation, and even rejection was in reality the triumph of God's Son. It's the ultimate irony. It's the ultimate irony. And so, as so frequently in Mark, conventional ideas of power and kingship, even glory and shame, are turned on their heads. The world is upside down. Jesus is enthroned in the least orthodox way and proven to be king by the resurrection from the dead. So while some people look at these events and see a joke and a mockery, God looked at the events and he saw his son, the one faithful human. And he said, worthy is the lamb who was slain. That's what he saw. So what are we to learn? Why an irony? Why tension? Why perspectives like this? Why is Mark doing this? Why do these events shape up this way? Well, I would suggest to you that this way of recording these events teaches us at least three things. The word's powerful. We'll go with three today, okay? Three things we learn from the irony. First of all, the irony teaches us that we've been given a different kind of king. A new kind of king. From the very beginning, mankind was given the image of God and a stewardship to have dominion, to guard and keep the earth, to make it fruitful, to make it a blessing, and in the way that God would do it, with kindness and care and attentiveness, to bring it to flourishing and to cause it to be very, very fruitful. But since the third page of our Jesus books, humans took a disastrous turn that might be summed up by the word exploitation. The use of people and things, the abusive use of people and things for my benefit. Exploitation. And human history is littered with the carnage of humans exploiting people and things for personal gain. The more power we are given, the more we exploit. It's a sad, sad story. Back in 2006, I was working at Briarcrest, and a film came out. It was, a kind of independent film. I don't know if anyone had heard of it. It was called Invisible Children. Has anyone seen that one? One, two? Oh, good, great. So three American university students had gone over to Sudan. They thought they were going to film about the war in Sudan. What they found instead was a very strange happening that was going on in Uganda. The film opens with a scene of some Ugandan children sleeping on the a concrete floor. And slowly the camera starts to zoom out. And you see, you remember this scene, right? It's very impactful. You see more and more and more children. And the facility's quite large, larger than this room. Perhaps even larger than this building. And the more he zooms out and pans, the more children you see. Hundreds and hundreds of children sleeping on a concrete floor. Maybe 1,000 kids. I'm just guessing. I haven't seen it in a long time. And so here they are gathered in this community center. And the three storytellers, the filmmakers, go on to tell about a dictator named Joseph Kony, who was kidnapping children each night and taking them away to his military camp, brainwashing them and training them to be soldiers in the war that he was fighting. So each night at dusk, the parents would gather their children to the community center where they could put guards around and protect them from being kidnapped. A terrible, terrible situation. And over about a decade, about 66,000 children were kidnapped, brainwashed, and enlisted, all with the goal of this man's political agenda. Exploitation in the worst kind of way. Exploitation and power have gone together since humans left the garden. And not all of them, all of these events are this extreme. I admit, this is a very extreme event. But often our exploitation fits with how much power we have. But from the beginning, God desired stewardship. He desired caring, guarding, and serving each other and creation, being fruitful. And after thousands of years of human failing, God sent his son, in the temptation of the wilderness, he proved that he would not seek his own. He would not seek shortcuts for personal benefit. In the Garden of Gethsemane, he wrestled with the depth of suffering, ultimately deciding that redemptive obedience to God was more important than his own benefit. And at the cross, he bore all the weight of human sin and exploitation. An innocent man humiliated for the sake of the Roman Empire and for the feeble power of a few religious leaders. A spectacle of human sin poured out. It really is the oddest thing that the people of Jesus' day called on Jesus to demonstrate the same kind of power that they resented in Rome. They hated Rome. They hated that they were dominated by Rome. And what they wanted Jesus to do was to do exactly the same thing to the Romans. Our minds are so shriveled by sin to imagine that the very thing that we detest about our life we want to do to someone else. It's a terrible thing. But Jesus came with a greater purpose, a servant king who would give his life as a ransom for many. He would take the last position, proving that he could be trusted to reign in righteousness and justice forever. See, the irony of this strange enthronement scene is crowns made of thorns and ridiculing homage that by placing himself in the lowest place, Jesus has become the ruler of all. So, the ironic enthronement also teaches us, though, about a new kind of kingdom that has been launched. Jesus came announcing the good news of the kingdom. He called us to change our ways because God's rule was invading the earth. the kingdom is marked by a whole different ethos, a different way of being in the world. The ironies of Jesus being mocked as king teach us something really important about his kingdom. See, the kingdom is made up of a people who would walk in the way of Jesus, who would follow his path of absorbing evil and not striking back. And we learn this in the ironies of the cross. A people who would love their enemies, who would learn to obey his teaching. It's a new kind of people that give themselves to what Jesus taught, even at great personal cost. And they let go of offense, and they love their enemies, seeking to bless them, and they spend their lives not for personal gain, but for the sake of the good news of Jesus. In their workplaces and their neighborhoods, they become sources of reconciliation. And instead of exploiting others sexually, financially, physically, they submit to each other, giving their best in kindness. And this really important word, love. Right? So the kingdom is made up of a people, but the kingdom is made up of a mission, a restoration project, God's healing work for broken hearts, broken lives. So the ironic enthronement tells us about the kind of life that God will bless, actually. It tells us that this strange enthronement is a call to the people of God to put themselves in the last place, to put themselves in the servant place, and so be blessed with the first place and true greatness. The upside-down enthronement teaches us to live an upside-down ethic. When we were in Nashville last week, we went to visit the Thistle Cafe. I brought my cup here, Thistle Cafe. Has anyone heard of Thistle Cafe? No? Okay. Well, we went to visit. It's a bit of a coffee shop and a small boutique. Could we call it a boutique? With candles and oils and other personal items. It was started by a woman named Becca Stevens. She's an Episcopal minister. Her father also was a minister, but was killed by a drunk driver when she was 5. Could have been the end for her. Could have been swallowed up by self-pity or resentment. Later in life, she was the victim of sexual abuse. Again, that could have been the end too. She could have been swallowed up by bitterness and unforgiveness. She went to Vanderbilt Divinity School and volunteered in projects with homeless women and folks struggling with addiction. And she took a position as a minister from which she launched a ministry to care for women who had been trafficked. The Thistle Cafe that we visited is staffed by the women in the 2-year residential program. It's really a beautiful thing that's going on there. The website says our program provides women survivors with free housing, health care, counseling, and job readiness training for 2 years. The Thistle Farms is a nonprofit social enterprise dedicated to helping women survivors recover and heal from prostitution, trafficking, and addiction. We do this by providing a safe place to live, a meaningful job, and a lifelong sisterhood of support. This is truly heartbreaking stuff. Most of the women we serve first experienced sexual abuse between 7 and 11 and began using alcohol or drugs by age 13 and first hit the streets between the ages of 14 and 16. Do you see the tentacles of exploitation here? It's awful. It's just awful. Traumatic childhood experiences give way to homelessness, addiction, further abuse, and incarceration, often compounded by poverty. We believe that love is more powerful than all the forces that drive women to the street, and a strong community will help them not only heal, but thrive. It's a beautiful experience to be there, to see the work they're doing. And two experiences for this woman, Becca, could have derailed her, but she chose the way of Jesus. She chose the way of forgiveness, and she embraced a different kind of king and a different kind of kingdom. She became a citizen of that kingdom. So, the ironic enthronement points us to a different kind of king and a different kind of kingdom, but the ironic enthronement also teaches us that new life is available. New life is available. Back in Mark chapter 10, when Jesus predicted his death and resurrection, he said this, "Whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be the slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. See, the Bible portrays that humans are held captive by the patterns that we've been discussing here, held under the power of sin and exploitation, evil and death. It's everywhere in our world. We don't have to look far for examples of this. And humans are held captive under this. And right here in Mark chapter 10, we see that Jesus saw his death as a ransom to set people free from that captivity. His death and resurrection offers a new kind of life to humans. And for all who attach themselves to Jesus by faith, who believe his words, that he gave his life as a ransom for many, he offers a fresh start, freedom, forgiveness, and a new life. He gave his life so that you could have a new one. A few years ago, I worked with a student. He had a funny nickname, so I think I can use it here. Johnny Random was his nickname. Anyway, that's what everyone called him. Johnny Random. He came to school in his late 20s. He had only just become a believer recently. He had struggled with mental health as a young man, and he had been self-medicating with drugs and alcohol. He wasn't in a really great place. And then one day, as a favor to his grandmother, he went to church on Easter Sunday. He was in bad shape, he told me, sitting in the pew. And they were singing hymn, dry old dusty hymns that he thought were meaningless. And somehow, in the pew that day, this guy, probably hungover, Jesus met him. The power of Jesus' ransom to set the captive free freed this young man. He ended up coming to Briarcrest. What an impact he had on all of us because of the new life that had been given to him through Jesus. New life is possible. We just need to pray and ask him, Jesus, forgive my sins and give to me a new life. Well, the ironic enthronement teaches us some very important things. It teaches us that the way of Jesus is very, very different than what comes naturally to us from our world. And I think what we see here is that it's a different kind of enthronement for a different kind of king and a different kind of kingdom. The ironic enthronement is not so ironic in the eyes of God. He saw it. He loved what Jesus did, and he raised him from the dead, and he's given Jesus the highest place, the place of authority. Worthy is the Lamb who was slain. Let's pray together. Father, we hardly scratch the surface at the depth of these truths. But Lord, that one thing that each of us needs, I pray that your Spirit would apply it to our hearts now. And Lord, if there are any here that don't know you, I pray that you grant to them the gift of faith and the gift of your Spirit to give new life. Thank you that we have a King who is not like all the others. Thank you for our kind and gracious, forgiving King.